Well, my next guest may be shocked by the specifics, but she isn't surprised at the turn of events in Mumbai, really. One of the key predictions of Dr. Coral Bell, who's been a major analyst of international relations for more than 40 years here and elsewhere, is that non-state actors will be very challenging in the new world order. In fact, she's rather optimistic about the world we're entering, though she always concedes that bad crisis management and some bad luck can hurtle us towards calamities. But she believes the emerging world observably requires and almost builds in greater cooperation between great and lesser powers. She believes we're in an odd situation, that we clearly remember Cold War stability. We contrast it with present volatility and then worry like mad. Yet we forget to consult history in order to learn how our forebears dealt with power shifts. Whereas the 19th century, she says, is a very useful model to examine, which had a 99-year peace with no big hegemonic wars. She's just finished a journal article called Power and Order in a Multipolar World to be published early next year. And given that we're expecting to hear Hillary Clinton announced, possibly later today, as the upcoming Secretary of State under President-elect Obama, it seems a perfect time to revisit the wise old soul Coral Bell. But I spoke to her before the full horror of Mumbai had unfolded.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Now, in your latest writing, you're particularly praiseworthy of Hillary Clinton's statements during the election campaign. In fact, you think that they trumped everybody else, including Barack Obama's, when she wrote in November last year that America's relationship with China would be the most important bilateral relationship in the world this century. There is much that the US and China can accomplish together. What attracted you about the wording and the tone of that statement?
Well, basically, it's realism, because if there's any quality that the Secretary of State really needs, it's realism. And there's also an element of aspirational hope for order in that statement of Hillary's as well. I mean, she believes that something can be done to keep the relationship on track.
Whereas, in fact, you said that John McCain and Barack Obama talked in that really neo-Wilsonian, you know, Woodrow Wilson allusions about the prospect of remaking the world. That really worries you,
yes,
does it?
That did a bit, but it was mostly John McCain rather than Barack Obama who talked that way. I think Barack Obama is a very realistic person as well, actually, and you can see that in the appointments he's made.
So have you got any thoughts about the likelihood of a foreign policy conducted by Hillary Clinton? We're expecting her to be announced probably in about 24 hours' time. You know, what's your sense of, will it look different to the average citizen in Australia?
I think it will, but perhaps not immediately. What the new administration has first to do is to get the economic crisis, the great global economic crisis, under control. And that task will be mostly, of course, for Obama's excellent assortment of economists that he's appointed, Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and Paul Volcker and all the others. He really has sort of stockpiled brains in the economic department, and that's what he's first going to need. And these are the people who have to hit the ground running.
And why is it so important to get that economic? I mean, I know the obvious answers, but I'm thinking foreign policy terms. Why?
Oh, well, it's rather desperate. I mean, if the world were allowed to fall into the sort of depression, please God it won't, but if it were allowed to fall into that kind of depression, we might have the sort of circumstances, political circumstances, that led up to World War II. And that would be most desperately appalling sort of set of events. Mm.
And yet you really believe that if somebody wants to sit and look forward in the midst of all of this sort of sense that the world is changing before our very eyes,
absolutely,
that actually the 19th century is a far more solid guide about where we might be heading. Why so?
Well, because the 19th century represented a multiple balance of power. The 20th century, mostly from the second half at least, was either bipolar power, that is to say just the US and the Soviet Union, or then a unipolar moment when the US was the unchallenged paramount power of the entire world. Now, that both of those times have passed, and we're back with a multipolar balance of power. Six great powers, about eight very important emerging powers, and six well-established, normally prosperous powers in Europe mostly, but including Australia. And these people, these governments rather, all have roles to play in the world that's emerging. Because what is principally happening in the world at the moment, well, firstly, there's globalization, of course, and secondly, there's climate change, but there's a third transformatory factor, which is the redistribution of power between states, between those 20 states, for instance, and between states and non-state actors. And the non-state actors, in many ways, are the least explored and possibly even the most dangerous of all.
Like who? You mean?
Well, like the jihadists, for instance, and I'm beginning to think like merchant bankers and such as well. Very radical thought. But if you look at what has transformed the world, what has been the policy of merchant bankers and such like financial wizards? Take the case of Iceland, not Ireland, Iceland. Tiny country, about the population of Canberra, but it very nearly overset the British financial system. Mm. That was almost incredible before it happened.
Now, those six great powers, six emerging powers, that's like the US, the European Union, Russia, China, India and Japan.
That's right.
Now, in fact, you say that really, and this is where it gets tricky, the concert of powers, which is a term that people in foreign policy worlds
that's
understand,
right,
is even more pertinent a term than balance of powers. Now, what's the difference?
Because a concert of power can only exist when there's a fairly stable balance of power. There are two sides of the same coin. In the 19th century, there was both a balance of power and a concert of powers, and most of the time the concert was in charge. But at various points, like, say, the Crimean and Franco-Prussian wars, the balance of power took over. So the two are not are really kind of inseparable.
And so in the concert of powers, there's a more overt collaboration between equals, is there?
Absolutely. And the great thing about the hopeful thing, shall I say, about the present world is that both the other two forces, the transformatory forces that we've got, which are globalization and climate change, both nudge the system in the direction of concert rather than balance, because both of them require very widespread, in fact almost universal, cooperation. They can't be solved by any one country. That's one of the things that Obama said when he was talking to the Berliners. He said, one country cannot solve all the problems of the world, and that's one of the reasons I see him as a realist too.
In a sense, you're still confident to talk about this mixed world, are you, despite the fact that the US has such military dominance? That's not something that we should factor in differently?
Yes. Everyone thinks that the US has such military dominance, but look at what has happened in the past 7 years. There was Afghanistan, a very primitive tribal society with nothing in the way of weaponry except Kalashnikovs and shoulder-fired missiles, and yet for 7 years America has not been able to make its will really effective in Afghanistan, and neither has it been able to make its will really effective in Iraq, because these peoples have discovered the techniques of what is called asymmetric war. Now, asymmetric war is war in which the two sides have different sorts of weapons and strategies. Mm. And that's what we've seen in both these countries. And the other side, so to speak, is doing vastly better than when anyone expected. Remember Bush saying, standing under that absurd message saying, mission accomplished. Remember Rumsfeld thinking the war was over after the first 3 weeks of the conventional battle in Iraq. It was just beginning then.
Yes.
The real war, the asymmetric war.
You are actually rather hopeful that it's possible that we might enter a period, if we're clever, that resembles the period 1815 after the Napoleonic War right through to the tragic World War One. That was 99 years of a really remarkably... Well, we didn't have war, put it that way.
Yes.
But you make the point that the people who were dealing with each other then were all mostly, frankly, white, European and Christian.
That's true.
Now, it's a very different group coming to the table now, aren't they?
That is perfectly true, but luckily, very luckily for us, both India and China have adopted the international norms of the Western Society of States. The present Global Society of States, in which India and China are so important, and the Islamic powers as well, is basically the European Society of States, as far as its norms are concerned, writ large. They just sort of basically took over the norms that had existed since about 1648 and applied them to the world as a whole. Now, that means that we won't, from those two great powers, if they are willing and able, as they are at present, to cooperate on the basis of those norms of recognising the sovereignty of other states, then we can make a concert of powers out of it.
Just to flip forward to post-World War II, when we had the last big bipolar moment, we had a bipolar jockeying for a position between the Soviet Union and the West, that it was very important that both powers became confident of reading the other's intentions. It was part of very clever crisis management.
That's
now,
right.
Where might that happen in this new world that you foresee coming?
Well, one of the things that happened after the most dangerous crisis of that Cold War world, which was the Cuba Missile Crisis of 1962, Kennedy and Khrushchev. Kennedy and Khrushchev managed that crisis like a chess game, a two-person game. But future crises are going to be a bit more like a rugby scrum, with everyone battling everyone else. And so we need the sort of communications that those two powers had between each other by that time and the conventions of crisis management which they'd worked out by that time.
So a new hotline between Washington and all the other capitals.
Washington and all the other capitals, I'd be absolutely in favour of it. And as a matter of fact, the sort of meetings we're having all the time at the moment, like the G20, are a first approximation to that. But a lot of more machinery could be installed. By the end of the bipolar period, that hotline between Moscow and Washington was manned 24 hours a day.
Mm. Final question, Coral. You have this a lovely term, an overarching term to describe where we are. You say it's the end of the Vasco da Gama era.
Oh, yes.
What are you getting at?
Well, for 500 years from the time of the great navigators of the late 15th century, you know, Vasco da Gama, Magellan and Columbus, the West has dominated the non-West. And Indian students, such as I used to meet in my youth in the London School of Economics, have resented that furiously ever since 1947. And they were always telling me that the Vasco da Gama era had finished. And I would say, plaintively, well, actually, the great powers are a bit powerful still. But now it's really true. The non-West is standing up for itself very much. China has stood up, as Mao Zedong once said, and he never spoke a truer word.
Coral Bell, always terrific to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Not at all, Geraldine. Great pleasure.
Coral Bell, who will be submitting that journal article to the Journal of the Australian Institute of International Studies. It's a quarterly publication. That'll be coming out early next year. And if you want to go to the Lowy Institute website, she published a monograph called The End of the Vasco da Gama Era, which I personally think is one of the best short overviews of where we are now to make it understandable for all concerned, whether or not you have any degrees in this. It's a really good read, so you might like to seek it out. Now, look, just a minute to go because we were going to do more letters now, but we'll try to do some later in the program. But the Mumbai story just grew a little bit. But we've had some expected response to Nuri Vitacci, who was the chair of the judging panel for the Australia-Asia Literacy Award last week. Remember, he said that there was very little creativity, literary creativity, in Asia. This is from Will. It tells us what the panel does not know or about this situation and that an inappropriate appointment has been made. It seems Vitacci does know literacy deserts of Hong Kong, at least this view is shared among by myself and among my Chinese friends, but it also indicates Vitacci does not know much about Chinese literacy or culture. No doubt it is a big challenge to select right persons, knowing the Australia-Asia rim for the judging panel, but let's hope the panel will do better in the future. And that was the tenor of several remarks that we had. So we'll try to canvass some more, as I said, later in the program. But don't go away. Margaret Atwood joining us after the news. It's now 8 o'clock.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.